Welcome to FSHD Straight Talk, the podcast where we dive deep into living with FSHD. I'm your host, Tim Hollenbach, and I'm on the journey with you. Having FSHD, I understand the challenges it brings to patients and their families. We're in this together, and this podcast is a space where we swap stories, share advice, and talk to experts to get the latest news. There's plenty to say about living with FSH muscular dystrophy, so let's get straight to it. Welcome all to another episode of the FSHD Straight Talk Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Hollenbach, and welcome to the show. We have a great topic, a fire hose of information bringing to you in this episode. So be ready. I hope that you have your energy drink in hand, or you've had a successful morning and you're energetic to hear all this information because you're going to need it. We have Michelle and Allie on. Michelle Melian and Allie Rowitz, who are going to come on and talk to us today about expanded access. What is that? It is about drug development. It's about drug trials. It's about involvement. It's about community. These topics that we talk about are important throughout all our episodes, but this one is extremely important. It energized me to make sure that this word does get out. Allie and Michelle both reached out to me via email, which you can too, at fshdradio@fshdsociety.org to talk about this topic, which I always extend that invitation to everyone out there. If you want to listen to the show and hear yourself on it, or there's a topic that you want to hear, and you maybe don't want to be a guest, but you want to make sure that we talk about something, fshdradio@fshdsociety.org is the way to do that. Love to hear from you. Also, follow the show. Listen to it wherever you can. It's available Spotify and Google Podcasts and everywhere. So share it. Share it like crazy if you can. I would love to see these episodes expand beyond our community. I think these stories are inspiring. This information is inspiring for a lot of people, not just our FSHD community. Imagine, if you will, right, if you wanted to have a treatment that was available, but it wasn't available to you. Sorry, you just out of luck. You're too young, or you're too old, or you're unambulatory, or you know what? You can't walk the XYZ amount. You just don't qualify. Sorry. But the treatment exists, but you can't get it. That's not fair, right? If anything in life, and even though we've all been told life's not fair, in this situation, life should be fair. And that's kind of where this expanded access comes in. How can you qualify for it? What are the steps to take? We talk about all those things. We unpack it. I have a table full of questions that I have throughout this episode, and Michelle and Allie bring it in this episode and explain it to you in a perfect way, from steps to impact to how it helps our community, how it even affects the world. We talk about that. So those are my takeaways. What is it? What are the steps to take? How does it affect not only our community, but throughout the world and of our community? And there's a lot of positive things to make sure you understand what expanded access is and how important it is. So without further ado, here is the conversation with Michelle and Allie. Welcome. As I said in this episode, we are talking about something that maybe some of us don't know. I definitely am one of those people that know a lot about this topic, and it is about expanded access. So we bring in Allie, we bring in Michelle, we're talking about expanded access. What is that? How does that relate to the FSHD community? Allie, you guys reached out to me to make sure we talked about this subject. As I researched and dove into it a little bit more, holy cow, this is like a big topic that needs to be addressed. So I'm glad that you wanted to do that and kind of give us some type of path here. So first question, what is expanded access? What are we talking about? Either one.
I'll start.
Or both, yeah.
Yeah, so... so basically the legal term, Tim, is really expanded access is an umbrella term where we're able to use medicines before they get market approval. And so this is a way to get access to an experimental therapy that may or may not be in clinical trials. And there are certain steps that you have to go through to have access to that therapy. Usually, in order to get access to experimental therapies, you have to go through a clinical trial and make sure that you qualify and meet all of the inclusion criteria and none of the exclusion criteria to be in a clinical trial. So typically, expanded access can be used by people with diseases like FSHD, and we're very lucky, as Ali had said, that we have some therapies in the pipeline that are in clinical trials. But there are people that may not necessarily qualify for those clinical trials. So expanded access may be a way for people to explore this pathway to get access. However, in order to start to begin to explore this pathway to get access, there are certain requirements. And the first requirement is really talking to your treating physician and having that conversation with your treating physician, making sure that they agree that the experimental therapy makes sense for you and that it's not going to put you at any undue safety risk. And so you and your physician should really start out with that conversation. And then also your physician has to agree that they want to take on the responsibility of contacting the company that is developing the therapy and also want to take on the responsibility of essentially becoming an investigator because they are going to have to either take the company's protocol or come up with their own protocol to submit an investigational new drug application to the FDA in order to have an expanded access protocol open. So, and very frequently that's actually not the hardest part. Sometimes the hardest part is actually getting the company to agree to give you the experimental therapy. And there are certain reasons why or why not companies may or may not want to provide that experimental therapy. Sorry, Tim, go ahead.
No. I was just, when you're saying experimental therapy, companies are a little bit worried. I immediately think liability in there.
And so there could be concerns from the company that if they give the experimental therapy outside of their already approved clinical trial, that they may not be able to monitor for adverse events or side effects is what we usually call them. And I think that but expanded access is a way where they can do that and can keep control of that. And it can be actually advantageous for them to engage in expanded access programs. And assuming that everything goes well, so like you realize that, oh darn, I don't qualify for this clinical trial. However, I think I would really benefit from this therapy. I go to my doctor, I say to my doctor, hey, can you help me get access? Your physician says, sure, okay, I have experience with doing expanded access. Or I'm happy to do it, or perhaps maybe they know somebody else that can help and support as you go through the protocol for the expanded access. The company agrees. The next is realizing that there might be cost to you as the patient and cost to your family because the insurance company, because these are not, remember, an expanded access, these are not approved therapies. They're not approved marketed therapies. And so, as a result, insurance companies are not required to cover the cost of that therapy, which the company may or may not give to you for free. Usually, they do with expanded access. But may not necessarily cover the costs related to giving you that therapy. So many of the new therapies require you to come to an infusion center and have certain tests before the therapy is given. And so your insurance company may say, this is not standard of care. We're not going to actually pay for the associated tests or for the time that you're in the chair getting that therapy. So these are all questions that, as people consider whether expanded access is right for them and they're exploring this possibility, they should be thinking about so that they're not surprised. And Ali has a lot of experience with this as well. And so please provide some additional details. I'm sure I've missed some, Ali.
We did a lot of the, you definitely checked a lot of the boxes that I know, before we hit record, we wanted to cover. It's like, what then is like the criteria? Like, who does it? Seems like the first thing you're going to do is like, do I qualify for a trial? Okay, I don't. So like, who is saying you don't qualify? Like, why don't they qualify? There might be some people asking that right now.
Yeah,
When I
so
qualify, they're probably even asking.
yeah, exactly. And so for each clinical trial, as a company is thinking about how to develop their therapy for a certain disease like FSHD, they try to think about what patients would most likely show a change on that therapy. And so based on analyses that may have been done, looking at natural history or even prior clinical trials, they set up really scientifically informed inclusion criteria, which usually includes age, how debilitated or affected by the disease you are, whether you have certain problems with your kidneys or with your liver, whether you've been sick recently, and whether you've had past or certain infectious diseases. For women, pregnancy or planning to become pregnant may or may not be a criteria. And so usually they are these set criteria that are really informed by scientific inquiry and what we've learned about the potential experimental therapy previously.
And then, Allie, from your point of view, yeah, like your experiences with this from that side of it, like what you've gone through, maybe even personally with this.
So from a patient's perspective, my son, he's 20 years old now. He has FSHD, early onset, childhood onset FSHD, severely affected. So he wasn't eligible for clinical trials because he was too young, right? He was under 18 for the Fulcrum trial and those earlier trials. And then he became non-ambulatory when he was 13. So now he's over 18, but he's still not eligible for a clinical trial because his disease has progressed to the point where he's severely debilitated. He's in a wheelchair. He's no longer eligible for, he's not included in the inclusion criteria. From right now, all the trials, you have to be able to walk 10 meters or whatever it is. So he's not eligible for any trial. He's progressing very rapidly. His lung capacity is down to 24%. You know, it's life-threatening and it's severely debilitating, which is sort of the criteria for expanded access. So for patients in his particular situation, younger patients, more severely disabled patient, this is a way for them to get access to the drug, not only before it's approved, but there's also some question after it gets approved if the label is very narrow, if it's just labeled for those that are in the inclusion criteria within that age range or within that severity range, it may be harder for him to even get access to the treatment after it's approved because insurance may say, well, this drug hasn't ever been proven safe or effective. And we've seen that with Duchenne and SMA, that the insurance companies may balk at that. So this is a way for him to get a treatment, him and many, many others like him, get a treatment before it's approved, but also to ensure if they gather some of that safety data and add to the safety database, it will benefit everybody in the FSHD community because once the treatment is approved, it may help bolster that safety database. So then insurance companies are more likely to reimburse or FDA is more likely to expand the label. So it's very important not only to help save the lives of these severely affected FSHD folks, but also to help the whole community once the treatment is approved.
So this data is super important from
I
that
believe it is,
perspective
yeah.
of opening the label, right? To expand it to other people without there being so many type of hurdles. So like what got a couple questions that popped in, but FDA, right? I mean, that's wandering in our conversation here. What role do they then play within this expanded access?
So when you're looking for expanded access for the drug, and Ali's right. So for the drug that's still in clinical trial, it's not necessarily approved, but once it's approved, it'll be approved for that population in which it was studied. And so you can apply for expanded access after the drug is approved, if you fall outside of the label. And that's a very common practice, actually, that physicians do. You always hear physicians, oh, they're using the drug off-label, but it works really well. And so some of that data, that off-label data that we get, or the reasons why insurance companies may cover it, come from the fact that some of that data might have come from people being granted expanded access to that drug, and through that expanded access protocol, you're able to generate additional safety data that supports the use of the drug beyond the population that was studied in the clinical trial from the for which it was approved. And I think that that was probably a bit circular. So I make it a little more linear. Before a drug is approved, you can get expanded access. You can still contribute to the safety database, which is really important, and that still contributes to the safety data related to people outside of the clinical trial. After the drug is approved, you can still apply for expanded access, and you also still contribute to that same safety database. So really the win here for everybody is that we learn more about the drug beyond which the clinical trial was designed for. And to Ali's point, the drug then can be used to benefit the whole community, and also people are reimbursed for it as well. It's not necessarily, it also gives the insurance companies, or can provide a part of the data that gives insurance companies that the therapy that you're getting is actually of a benefit to you.
So, Tim, can I add just one thing about the
Please.
FDA? So the FDA has to approve the IND, right? So for expanded access, the physician, and correct me if I say anything wrong here, Michelle, the physician will put in for the IND. It goes to the FDA, and then the FDA approves it, and then they give the okay back to the physician to run that protocol for that individual or group of patients. But I just want to give you some information about the FDA. The FDA approves 99% of all expanded access requests. That is
Nice.
on the FDA.gov website. And they did a study because a lot of companies are very risk adverse. They don't want to expand it out before they get it approved because they think there's going to be an adverse effect and then it'll mess up the trial. And I hear this all the time. But the FDA implemented this program to get this drug to those more severely affected in a more timely manner and to help bolster the label. So they did a study over 10 years and 10,000 trials that use expanded access, and not one of them has kept a drug from getting approved. Not one. So when companies come back, and I understand that, that they want to put all their eggs in getting this approved, but when they come back and say, if you request expanded access, you're going to ruin it for the whole community, there's just no facts to support that, right? It hasn't in 10 years and 10,000 trials, and this is a program that the FDA has implemented to help those people and to help the drug.
So there's not really a negative then, it feels like, by asking for the expanded access.
Well,
yeah, I think that there's no negative. You can always ask for expanded access. And again, walking through that process, making sure that your physician agrees that the drug would be beneficial to you and they're willing to take on that responsibility. You can always ask the company, and all companies by law have to have their expanded access policies posted. So you can go to that company and look at what their expanded access policy is. So you can always ask. To Ali's point, there could be several reasons why companies may say they're not ready to engage in an expanded access program. One of them could be, as Ali had said, is that there is concern about about the fact that they may not necessarily have complete understanding of the adverse event profile, and so, or side effect profile, I should say. And so as a result, they want to understand more from the clinical trial before allowing expanded access to occur. Additionally, there are other reasons that could come into it that are business reasons. They may not have enough drug to support an expanded access program. As you all know, money to, and I hate to bring this into it, but money is tight. And so some programs may not be funded or have the appropriate funding to allow an expanded access program to occur. And so there are many different reasons, but Ali is absolutely right. From a from a benefit standpoint and from a learning standpoint, we can certainly learn more about the safety profile, especially outside of that defined population in the clinical trials, so that it could support the data to treat more people in the community.
And from a patient perspective, also, it is an experimental treatment. You have to go in knowing that there could be some serious side effects, like if you join any clinical trial. So I would just say, we all want a treatment. We all want to treat our kids, but you do have to take that into account. This is an experimental treatment, and we don't, and it hasn't been completed. So before you take your kid there and say, "Give this to my kid," you need to consider that, or to yourself that, this is experimental, and there are risk always with taking any sort of medication, especially when it hasn't been FDA approved. And Al, sorry, Tim.
No, go ahead. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I just wanted to also just remind people is that even if the FDA allows the expanded access program to proceed, or expanded or administration of drug to proceed through expanded access, still, that does not necessarily mean your insurance company is going to pay for all of the activities that are related to that. So make sure that, even if you get through these other parts, that you double check with your insurance company so that you understand what your responsibility may be should you decide that an experimental therapy or a therapy that has been approved but not yet approved for your population, if you decide to pursue that path.
It does come down then, yeah, to insurance covering the costs, and then if they don't, can you afford it yourself? There's a lot of risks involved there. So how does a family balance, the risk with the side effect risk, right? Costs, and then the hopes that this would work.
Right. And I think it always comes down to risk benefit. And Allie would love to hear your thoughts on this.
So I think, to Michelle's point, that you need to have that conversation with your clinician, your doctor, right? What is the risk benefit? How severely affected it are you or your child? What do you know about the drug? And then have that conversation with your doctor first. But if there is a risk benefit in the safety profile, normally they don't open up expanded access till the end of phase two, phase three. So they have a pretty good understanding of the safety profile at that point. Then you just have to make the personal decision first whether or not you qualify for it. If your physician feels like you do qualify under expanded access and they want to take on that responsibility, and then go forward, talk to them and then go forward with requesting it from the company. But a lot of time it just comes down to the company whether or not they are willing to give out that drug, because no one can make them do it. The FDA can't make them do it. The clinicians can't make them do it. The patients can't make them do it. It's a company decision whether or not they want to expand that out. So, if you feel like you and your doctor that this would be great for you, you feel like you got it all worked out, but the company says we're not comfortable with offering expanded access right now, there's not really a whole lot that we can do other than keep asking, right? Talk to our physicians, have our physicians ask, because really it's their decision whether or not they want to give out the drug. I would hope that they would at some point, to not only help the individuals that fall outside the inclusion criteria, but also to help bolster the safety data as we talked about for their drug. But again, nobody can really make them do it.
Do you think that the drug companies, pharma, believes that opening that expansion helps with data and making their findings more robust? Because it sounds like there's almost a little bit of resistance from them more than anywhere else.
It depends on where the company sits, Tim, in the sense of where they are in their clinical trial, their clinical program, and how comfortable they really feel with that adverse event profile and monitoring for that adverse event profile, or I should say side effects, or having people monitor for that side effects. Of course, more data for a safety database is always beneficial, because the more you know about your drug, the better you can monitor for those side effects and treat people, and then also treat more people, and you always get more information. And I don't think that it comes, and I don't think that it I think it's a multifactorial decision for these companies. And as I said, obviously, when we're developing drugs and thinking about our drug development programs, we want to treat the whole community. The pharmaceutical company wants to treat the whole community. They want to treat as many people as possible, but to do that safely. And to Ali's point, it's about that risk-benefit and really having a good understanding of that risk-benefit. Even if it falls outside, well, having a good understanding of that risk benefit within the population that you've defined for that clinical trial, and then feeling comfortable to saying, okay, we have a good understanding. We're now willing to expand it out and explore other populations because the goal in mind is to treat as many people as possible. And again, I hate to bring up the business because the pharmaceutical industry is a business. But it also depends on how much drug is available because they need to make sure that that clinical trial is supplied and supplied for the whole time that they've planned that clinical trial. And as you all know, that can be for multiple years, up to 5 years sometimes. And then also, do they have the money to support both the clinical trial and expanded access? And so I think it's a multifactorial decision. But I can tell you, as somebody who has worked in the industry as well as with the FSHD Society, the goal is to treat as many people as possible, as safely as possible, realizing, to Ali's point, that people are willing to take more of a risk-benefit knowing that these are experimental treatments. But we don't yet, we're close, thankfully, to having approved therapies. And so I think that once we do have approved therapies, this conversation, I'm hoping will change and we will see a lot more expanded access or access to expanded access programs. And I'm hoping that we see that very soon.
But like from our
Definitely.
perspective as well, Tim, time is muscle. We know this, right? And when you have a child that's on the verge of losing ambulation, who's deteriorating, you have someone like my son who's a little bit older and severely disabled, we want access to the treatment as quickly as possible. Waiting 3, 4, 5 years, sometimes can make a huge difference in their
Unacceptable.
life. So I think, from the patient's perspective and the pharmaceutical perspective and the FDA perspective, we all have to kind of come together and make a decision on what's best for the patient and for the community. And sometimes those are at odds because we, as the patient community, always want it sooner rather than later, especially for those very severely affected individuals, like I said, are on the verge of losing ambulation or on the verge of going to like a trach or a Holter lift or that next big step where you're just like, gosh, I got to get my kid or my loved one something now rather than later, right? So I think keeping these conversations open and making sure that the pharmaceutical companies understand that, especially particularly with FSHD, it's not always a benign, slow progressing disease, that there are folks out there that need these treatments sooner rather than later, and that they need to consider that this population would benefit greatly from early access to these treatments, I think is something that we need to keep pushing for.
Is there any, you kind of danced towards the direction of some misconceptions, right? Of its expanded access. What have you found are the most common ones when you've talked to, if it's patients or families about getting involved this way? What are some of the things that they say that you're like, no, that's not right?
So from the pharmaceutical company or not even the pharmaceutical companies, but in the community, and that's why I keep regurgitating this FDA data, because they say, oh, if you put somebody in expanded access and they have an adverse effect, then nobody's going to get the treatment. And that's just not true, right? Even if you did expanded access, because they understand, and it's written very plainly on the FDA website, that they understand that this is a different population. They might be a little bit more fragile. They might have a few more comorbidities. That's why they didn't qualify for the trial in the first place. So they understand that this is a population that's outside the inclusion criteria. So if there is an adverse effect or some safety indication there, they understand that it might be due to something that's not common within the maybe the community. So I think that's one of the biggest misconceptions, that if somebody goes into expanded access and they're a little bit more progressed or they're a little bit more fragile and something, God forbid, happens, that then it's going to blow it up for everybody and nobody's going to get the treatment. But that's just facts indicate that that's just not the case, right? So I think that's the thing that I hear the most, that don't push this because you're going to ruin it for all of us, and that's just not the case.
Yeah, I think that that data that you cited, Ali, is really is very powerful. I 10,000 early access programs, and not a single one has resulted in a delay of a drug approval, I think is extremely powerful data in support of early access programs, and really companies thinking very seriously to engaging in those programs as quickly as possible.
You talked about IND. Some people might go, "Well, how do I do that? Like, is there paperwork? Like, what do I do?" I think the overwhelming side of this can kind of, paralyze people, so to speak, of even making a step forward because they're not sure what to do. Maybe they're interested, maybe they're not, but that might stop them. So, two-part question. Maybe what's the first step? What's that roadmap? Do this, do this. We said talk to your doctor first, see if you qualify for trials. We see that's kind of being a path. When they get to that IND part, how do they go about achieving that?
So when you go and you talk to your doctor and you and your doctor decide that it's appropriate for you to pursue treatment with the experimental therapy, then your physician has to then engage with the company, and you will also likely give the company a call and say, "Hey, like my physician says that I'm a good candidate." They will engage with your physician as well, and so the physician will that you're working with, your doctor, will either be given a protocol, or they will have to come up with their own protocol for the early access program, and then they will also have to, the doctor is responsible for filling out the investigational new drug application. And I think, Ali, I believe that this an example of an IND has been shared, or there are people who are willing to share what they have put in their investigational new drug applications. They can take some time to fill in, and that really is that onus is really on your doctor to fill that out, because they are considered the principal investigator for that early access program. And so it's on them really to submit that to the FDA. And as Ali said, the usual timeline for any IND is 30 days. And then if you don't hear anything from the FDA, that's good, and it means you can go on and start treatment.
So, Tim, the first step is going on to the pharmaceuticals website, and according to the 21st Century Cures Act, they have to publicize their expanded access policy. So anybody who's in clinical trial right now in phase two or three, they have to publicize it. So you go on there and you click on expanded access, and it'll tell you what the policy is. And sometimes the policy is we are not exploring expanded access at this time. And it's completely up to them. And if they say we're not exploring expanded access, you can still go talk to your doctor. Your doctor can still have that conversation with them. But if they say no, they say no, right? There's not really a whole lot of recourse other than maybe keeping the pressure on them. And maybe it's not a matter of they're not ever going to do it, but they're not going to do it right now. So maybe the question then is, if not now, then when? And then they'll, if they decide then to update their expanded access and they decide to offer it later, then they'll update that policy and say, okay, now expanded access, we're going to offer expanded access in this indication. And then you would start that process, go to your doctor. And they really are the ones that have to do all the paperwork, right? And we did have a 13-year-old approved for expanded access with Fulcrum for losmapimod. And that's exactly how it worked. Worked with the doctor, Fulcrum agreed to supply the product. They did an IND, it went to the FDA. The FDA approved it really quickly. It came back. But then, like Michelle said, there was a lot of devils in the detail. Then, how do they get the drug? Who are they going to pay? How are you going to pay the pharmaceutical tech to take the drug? How are you going to pay the nurse to administer the drug? Like, there's a whole lot of stuff in there, and that can be worked out with the company or your insurance and all the things, or the institution. But there's a lot of details that need to be worked out. And unfortunately, while they're working out those details, Fulcrum pulled losmapimod and she didn't get dosed. But the process worked. The sponsor agreed to give the drug, FDA approved it. The doctor did all the work. They got it all worked out. And then just unfortunately, the trial ended then. So it can be done, but the first step really is whether or not the pharmaceuticals, like Michelle, gave a lot of reasons why they don't want to. They have to agree to supply that experimental drug.
Interesting. That's a nice pathway. I'm all about logistics, step one. I think that's my male genes in me. But it doesn't seem that super difficult, is it? But does it take like a lot of time? Like, what's the timeline of what you just described, Allie? Because you said, time is muscle. So what's the
So
timeline when you do these
with
things?
this particular instance, it went pretty quickly. Once
Okay.
the pharmaceutical agreed to give the drug and worked with the physician, then the FDA turned it around pretty quickly. Then it was just a matter of working out all the details with the institution about handling the drug and administering the drug. That took probably the longest time because there's just contractual things about how they're getting paid and all the nonsense that goes along with anything you do in the medical field with working it out with your insurance or who's paying for what. So once that was worked out, I mean, I think it was maybe a 6 month process. It wasn't
Okay.
that long after they agreed to say yes, but again, the first step is the pharmaceutical agreeing to say yes, and there's a lot of reasons why they won't, but hopefully at some point they all will. Right, because we got to get these treatments to those outside the inclusion criteria. We just have to.
Yeah, we just have
We as
to.
a community can't stand for just a portion of our community getting treated and the rest of it being left behind. We just can't stand for that.
Yeah, you
You
took the
know,
words out of my mouth there. Yeah, go ahead,
yeah.
Michelle.
One other big part that we also that I did neglect to mention and is that once there is agreement, you submit the IND. You also have to, your physician also has to go to your their hospital's IRB, which is which is an ethics board, to review the application as well as to review the protocol. And so that's just one other step. It's usually an institution meeting that has to happen. And so as Ali said, very correctly, is, first of all, understanding what the company's policy is, talking to your doctor, then talking to a company, getting agreement for them to supply the drug, submitting your IND application, as well as talking with the local IRB, which is the ethics committee, or your institutional review board, and then once all that is that's approved, then working out the details for how the drug will be administered, and then obviously payment.
Go from
And then
there.
IRB, correct me if I'm wrong, Michelle, is there to protect the patient, to make sure
Correct.
that they're doing it, that they understand what they're getting into, that they have informed consent, that they're doing all the things, and that they understand what it means to enter that trial.
Yes, that is correct. And I think for things like this, Allie, I don't and Tim, I don't think it's necessarily a big hurdle. IRBs are extremely reasonable. I think that to your point, they just want to make sure that the conduct of the protocol is being is appropriate and that really that patients and their families understand what they're getting into and that the literature that they're given is very clear in saying what that, again, going back to that risk benefit, right? So really having the family understand what is the risk and the benefit of being part of this trial.
Something just occurred to me. Maybe this is a really bad question, but let's say, because there's multiple trials happening, right? Let's say they start to do it for one, and let's say it's successful. I mean, then they're to get through, or let's say it's not successful. I mean, are they allowed to jump then to another one and then go try that one?
You're bringing up a great point, Tim, because so if the trial is successful, let's say the drug is approved, what can happen, you're on an expanded access, what can happen is that you just go on the drug as a marketed therapy, right? The wrinkle is what if the drug is not approved? Or the trial is stopped for whatever reason, but you still think you're getting benefit. And then the question then becomes, then how are you still provided that drug? And to Ali's point, at that point, the company can no has the right to no longer supply the drug. If they're no longer producing it, they have the right to no longer supply the drug. And that is a risk. That certainly is a risk.
But that's
But
a
then,
risk if you're in a trial as well. Normally, they have something called
correct.
open label extension. So you go through, like, say, phase two or phase three, and you're finished, and maybe you're on placebo, and they give you the drug, and then you're on the drug. And this happened with people on losmapimod. They were given the drug, and they thought it was benefiting them. When they pulled the plug, they took all the drug back from them too. That's just, I mean.
So I think that the message here, though, is that even though you're not in a clinical trial per se, early access is a clinical trial. It's more of like an N of one clinical trial to see how you are benefiting in it, and if you could potentially benefit while you also contribute your data back to the community to hopefully benefit others in the community, so that at you build that safety database supportive of the drug, and that and when the drug is approved, it makes it easier for other people to get the therapy as well.
But then let's say it is not approved. Can you go to another drug company's trial then and try for that one? Or are
Well,
you going to
it
be
depends.
denied?
Yeah, so it depends, because a lot of these drug trials will say you cannot be on another experimental therapy at the same time, or you have to go through something called a washout period. And a washout period means how long it takes for that drug to get completely out of your system. Because when you're designing these clinical trials, you want to make sure that the effects that you're seeing are actually from the drug you're evaluating, and not necessarily from some other external, I want to say confounder or external element that might be influencing your response to that drug. So it might mean that if you think you qualify for another trial, so let's say you're on expanded access, for some reason it fails. You decide there's another trial that opens that actually looks like you might be a candidate for, you would just have to wait that washout period for that drug, and then you could likely then be in that clinical trial. Now, that is for gene modulating therapies like ASOs, or small molecules like Fulcrum's losmapimod. But if you're in a gene therapy trial, that's a completely different animal altogether, and you would then be excluded from any trial at this point, because the washout period for the gene therapy is supposed to be a one dose and done kind of thing. And so there is no washout period for that. So if you do a gene therapy, then that is not an option for you.
A little bit of risk in there, right? A little bit, but all of
Yeah.
this seems to have the risk involved, and we've really concentrated on the USA and FDA and all these things within our neighborhood, our neck of the woods. How about globally? Does it make a positive impact? What you're telling us here, does that make an impact in the world when we're trying to do treatments and so forth?
Yeah. So the EMA and the UK actually have similar pathways that the US does. We call it expanded access in the US, in the UK, and in the EU. I said EMA, sorry. And in the EU, that's the regulatory authority. And in the EU, they have something called name patient, where at the hospitals, they can say this drug is specifically for this patient, and depending on the country's policies, they may or may not have to go through regulatory approvals. They may just be able to say, go to their institutional ethics boards, and not necessarily have to go through a full regulatory approval. If it's named patient, it's specifically for that patient. And then in terms of their reimbursement, if that's also dependent on the country. They can also so that and that's usually done through a hospital. They can also do something called compassionate use, which can be for several patients, and that also has its own regulatory path. And but certainly there are parallel paths, and the risks and benefits here apply. Although you might say, well, like, as a named patient, if I just have to go to the hospital and tell my doctor I want to do this, that seems pretty easy. I'm going to move to Italy and do that. But it's not. The physician actually in the institution assumes a lot of risk. So, but there are parallel pathways, and I think regulators are trying to flex to meet the growing need and demand from patients living with rare disease, to make sure that we are accelerating development of these therapies. It's so important, and it's been too slow, frankly, in rare disease. And we're holding clinical, and I'll just get on my soapbox for just a second here. We're holding rare disease therapies to a standard that was developed for larger diseases like diabetes, cardiac disease, things like that. And so the expectations from these clinical trials we haven't been able to meet it, because you're essentially taking a structure that was designed for these much larger diseases and trying to plop it onto rare disease. And so I think that the regulators are beginning to wake up and realize this, and we should see some changes in the regulations in terms of rare diseases and development of therapies for rare disease. Specifically, there are organizations within the FDA as well as and the UK and the EU that are specifically looking at rare disease therapy and development and how we can accelerate it.
That's hopeful, because yeah, I think everybody would agree it takes too long. Just like you said, it just takes too long. It's about time, a race for time. And
Exactly. And I can't tell you, it's time. And Ali's right. Time is muscle, and people realize that. And so the places like the Rare Disease Innovation Hub with the FDA, there's also the Rare Therapies Launchpad with the MHRA, and then there's a special unit in the EMA that's specifically looking at this and trying to modify the structure or just break the structure down entirely and build something new so that we can meet the needs of people living with rare diseases.
what's ultimately then, the call to the community here? I love the fact that you wanted to talk about this. It's something that I wouldn't have seen as a topic point, which is why I ask all the world that listens to this, hey, you got topics you want to talk about? Please tell me. And Ali's like, hey, we got to talk about this. So what's the call to the community? What do you need them to do? What are we empowering them to take steps forward?
So I would think the first thing is just being educated on it, and then when somebody says, like, if you are pushing for expanded access, or if then you're going to harm the whole community, to say no, that's not true, and to look at the FDA.gov website and say these are the facts, and this is why this program exists. And if you or a loved one has a really severe form of FSHD and you need this sooner rather than later, to ask the questions, go ask your clinician, talk to your doctors, keep the pressure on them to open it up and let you decide what the risk benefit is, either for yourself or for your child. Because I think there is a large population, or at least a significant population, that don't have 4, 5, 6 years to wait, because they will lose significant function or their life before that happens. So I think just being educated on it to make sure that you speak in facts and the truth. And when somebody says things like this that aren't true, look it up for yourself, maybe, or reference what I'm saying, and talk to people who know, right? And push back, because the whole Cure FSHD for All website that we started was, we can't let a certain population get the treatment and then wait years for everybody else, because a lot of times everybody else, they don't have that time. And again, as a community, we should demand that we all cross the finish line together. We can't leave our kids or non-ambulatory and severely affected behind. And I think that is my call to the community, that we're all in this together. SMA did it, Duchenne's doing it, and we need to do it as well, and speak in one voice for all of us.
Well said, man. So, last question. So, I want to make sure we didn't leave any stone unturned because of the size of this topic, in my opinion. So, any like last thoughts to make sure that we've covered all our bases? Or did we?
I think it's important for everybody living with FSHD and in the FSHD community to be sure to know that you all are the experts on your disease. We learn a lot more from you than you learn from us. And so I highly recommend, as Ali so eloquently said, is just to be educated, be involved, ask questions, push back. Let us know what is important to you, and that you're likely willing to accept more risk than we assume. And again, we're all here. We want to create one therapy. Well, not one therapy, but we want to create therapies that treat the entire community. And so we can only do that if you all tell us what you need. And by working together, we will get there. We will have therapies to treat the underlying cause of FSHD.
Allie, anything else?
No, as well said, Michelle, that's what we just need to all get there together. And it's not soon enough for any of us, but I think by working together with, it's like a three-pronged stool, right? We need the clinicians, we need the patients, and we need regulatory and sponsors all working together to make sure that they understand the burden of FSHD.
Awesome. Thank you both for sharing this all with us. A lot of great information, educated me for sure. It's got me a little bit fired up, I'm not going to lie, because I think it's a great thing that we should be involved in. Fire hose of information, granted, but I think needed. So thank you, Allie. Thank you, Michelle, for being on the show. And we'll have you on again, I guess, in the future, right? I mean, this is going to be an ongoing topic, if you ask me.
Absolutely. Thank you,
Yes.
Tim.
You're
Thank you,
really
Tim.
welcome. Take care.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you, Allie.
That is the least to say, right? A fire hose of information that was brought to you. I know you really can't see necessarily how my little podcast questions world is here, but there is probably one of the topics I have the most laid out in front of me of areas of the conversation that it could have went to, it should go to. Our pre-conversation was very informative as well, and I think that was all brought to the recorded session here. The fact that Michelle and Allie put so much time, effort into this to know the ins and outs, up and down of all of it, so that you don't have to go research all of it. It was just right here for you in a package, right? This is what you do. This is how you do it. If you feel like you want to do this, hey, if it doesn't work out, you can do this. There really is no excuse that if you're interested in getting that expanded access, the path is there. And it doesn't sound extremely difficult. It might take a little more time than you want, but I'm glad it exists, to be honest with you. I mean, that was the part I think I took away from this was a sense of relief that at least there is expanded access option, that it's not just a cut dry, sorry, you don't fall in this criteria, so you're out of luck. That's not what you want to hear. This at least gives you hope that you could be involved in it. I wanted to make sure that we talked about not just those here in the US, but beyond our borders of other places in the world that are like, hey, I might be listening to this. This is a global thing. They can listen to this and they might think to themselves, how does this affect me? I wanted to make sure I tied that in too. And Michelle and Allie were very eloquent in how to do this, who it touches, why is it so important? It's a call to the community. And your call can honestly, you can direct your attention to the curefshdforall.com website. It is a great website. The frequently asked questions are fantastic. It gets everything you need to do. There's a get involved button right there. You get involved. There's a sign a petition. I think that's a good spot to start too, and get yourself educated. And if you want to move forward in this, if you believe that you're part of the groups that you're not going to qualify for these trials, you are going to help the other people in your similar situation by just even the data that gets collected. So there's a lot of positive things. I'm really glad that they had the time to talk to us about this and educate us, including myself. Fantastic, fantastic episode. If there's topics you want to talk about, make sure you reach out to me, fshdradio@fshdsociety.org. I've had a fantastic a year thus far talking to these amazing guests. We've had a great walk and roll episode. That was fun to put on. And I know there's more guests out there. I know there's more people that want to tell their story. I want to hear from you. I really do. I can't say that enough. I think I've proven that if I either find you on social media and think you'd be a great guest, I'm probably gonna reach out to you. You can always say no, right? I'm not gonna pressure you, but I really believe you kind of need to tell your story or to bring that topic up that we need to talk about because it benefits the community. It benefits everybody. A we before me type attitude. Just benefits everybody. So fshdradio@fshdsociety.org. Thanks again to the FSHD Society for helping bring this podcast to you each and every episode and all the bonus ones as well. Aaron and Anne on the back end here that you don't see doing all the editing, doing all those things that I don't really love to do. I'd rather just talk to the people and hit record. They do a lot of great work. So I always a special, special thank you to them. And thank you to Michelle and Allie for being on this episode. So till next time, take care of each other. And you've been listening to FSHD Straight Talk.